All right.
Very quickly looking at chapter 6, as I said, I don't want to just spend a ton of time in the sixth chapter, largely because a lot of what we'll find really from this point forward for a lot of the rest of the book will be looking back at what has come before. We'll see in chapter 7, we'll talk about that more in a moment, it is definitely looking back at an earlier section, but it is kind of giving a bit more more commentary, kind of serving an explanatory role with some of those things that have come before. Chapter 6, I mean, I don't want to call it rehashing at all. There's still very vital information in there, and of course, it's always going to be useful to study. But a lot of what we find in there is just along the same lines with what we've looked at, especially focusing on primarily what we see quite a bit of in chapter 6 are just sort of the problems, the difficulties in life that are seemingly inescapable, and just some unanswerable questions, just some difficulties in life that we can't really seem to solve in any way if we are bound to the kind of purely secular, purely worldly view of things, that life under the sun that we've talked about. If that's where we're anchoring ourselves, everything that's found in chapter 6 is just really going to stick in your craw. It's just really going to prove ruinous to your life. And so it's the same kind of wrestling that the writer has been doing for five chapters before, but just kind of looking at these things and saying, here's life. If this is all there is, if this is the only thing that we have to look forward to, what's the point, or how do you figure out any sense in all of this? And really, those are just kind of open-ended, unanswered questions in chapter 6. For instance, the first six verses or so, I've mentioned there injustice or misfortune. I don't know which would be more appropriate. He has to do with God, is who he's dealing with in the first six verses. God is the party that is not allowing this man to enjoy what he has acquired. And it's not said why, you know, the means, why that happens. Maybe his life is cut short as soon as he hits it big. Or maybe like the guy we met in chapter 5, he gains all these things through hard work, but then loses them through just kind of bad business. There's no real reason given. And I'd say maybe injustice is not the right word, because the writer doesn't offer a judgment on how fair it is or not. If God is doing it, then it is justice. If God is doing it, then you won't be able to look at it and say, hey, this wasn't fair. Why did this happen to me? But again, from kind of the earthbound standpoint, we would have to call it injustice. But here's a man who essentially those things that he's mentioning there in verse 3, you know, begets 100 children, lives many years. Those are, especially in that day and time, those are kind of the things that you would want more than anything else. A long life, many children, that's how you measure a person's wealth and his success in life, his value, those kinds of things. If you had all of that, but for some reason were prevented from enjoying it, then what would have been the point in your life? It really would have been better if you were never born, is the conclusion that he reaches there. Or you begin looking around in verse 7 and see that the hard work that a person is given to for his whole life, just the realities of being a man who has to toil and has to labor. Well, in verse 7, the labor of a man is for his mouth, and yet the soul is not satisfied. We work so that we can make it to the next meal. We work so that we can just continue providing for our physical needs. Well, what kind of answer, what kind of satisfaction does that give to the inner man, to the one that might be hungry for something else beyond that? Well, nothing. You're not going to find any of that in your work. It's all just kind of this pointless treadmill. You work so that you can continue living, and you continue living so that you can just do more work. And that's kind of compounded beginning there in verse 8. If you are one of those unfortunate who are poor and you're not the wealthy man, you might know how to walk before the living. There at the end of verse 8, he's kind of looking at a guy with a good reputation. He's well thought of by people. He might have some of that practical wisdom. He knows how to relate to others. But problem is, he's not a wealthy man. Well, What benefit is that? What good is even wisdom in that case if you're still just going to be this poor, oppressed, downtrodden person? The conclusion he reaches in verse 9 would be better to just be able to have things that you can actually see and actually hold on to rather than just working to try to make a success of yourself. The wandering of the eyes, that's not ever going to actually offer you any fulfillment. In the final tally, the conclusion he reaches at this point, again, these are all these kind of preliminary conclusions along the way. The man who is purely under the sun is in a bad state. He can't really improve himself. Verses 10 and 11, I would say it's not clear whether or not he's talking about God. The New King James capitalizes some of the pronouns there, like at the end of verse 10. Man cannot contend with him, capital H, God. Man can't contend with God who is mightier than he. That could be what's in mind. I kind of lean towards seeing it that way, actually, just the way this is all set up. But it could just be talking about another person who is mightier than he. The point of all of that is just simply to say, you can't really do that much to change many things in your life. You've already been named and known. There's precious little that you can do to break out of whatever that allotted state might be, as he is seeing things right now. So you can't improve your station. If you are purely earthbound and you're only looking around and trying to find answers within yourself or society or this world, who knows what is good for man in life in verse 12? And that's a kind of a negative rhetorical question that sort of answers itself. Nobody knows. There's no way to actually build your life on any kind of moral principles that have lasting value if you're not looking beyond anything here. Who knows what's good? Well, nobody. Who can tell a man what will happen to him under the sun? Nobody. There's no certainty for the future. So the end here in chapter 6 is once again very depressing. And that's what the preacher has tried to do over and over again throughout the book, is reveal the facade, reveal the foolishness, the wastefulness, the dissatisfaction that comes from ordering your life by any of these things, through trying to simply grab as much gain as you can, trying to be as wise as possible and just figure out every answer in life, live a long time and enjoy yourself and just be as happy as possible all the time. If that's where the answers are found, you end up with this depressing result at the very end of it. If you gave it an honest look, I don't know how to do any better than what I'm doing. I don't know what's right or wrong. I don't know what's going to happen to me during or after any of this. It's very bleak. It's a very bleak outlook. From this point on, we're going to start seeing some of the rebuilding of here's how you need to look at it. We've seen hints before that, but I think it especially starts here kind of in this back half of the book. All right, questions, comments on chapter 6. I know I just kind of breezed through that, but anything that sticks out, anything to point out here in chapter 6 before we go on? Yeah, Rob, go ahead. Yeah.
To me, probably just me, but that points back to God having put eternity in our hearts, so we're not satisfied. You know, we can't necessarily be satisfied with the physical or the carnal or the things of this earth. And it points forward to Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount saying that those who hunger and thirst after righteousness will be satisfied.
Yeah. And that's a good point there from verse 3. It goes back to what he said in chapter 5 as well. Chapter 5, verse 10. He who loves silver won't be satisfied with silver. That's what you're chasing after. Those don't actually fill any holes. But I like the looking forward as well. Think of all of those offers that Jesus always makes to the people who would come to him. Bread of life. You eat that, you're not hungry again. If you ask me for the water that I can provide, you'd never be thirsty again. All the offers that he makes are for this very thing that man can't find in anything else: satisfaction, filling that hole, and putting that final piece in place that allows man to actually have contentment and satisfaction. It's only found one place. Yeah, good observation there. All right, let's begin looking at chapter 7 then. And here again, I'm not going to spend hardly any time on this. I'm just putting this graphic up to illustrate kind of how we're approaching this in chapter 7, these first 14 verses. There are a lot of different ways of organizing Ecclesiastes and kind of seeing its structure, but I find this one to be pretty useful, pretty on point. I've referred to this book before in other classes, but the two things you would compare there in chapter 3, verses 1 through 15, that's one of those very famous passages, especially the first 8 verses. We looked at that some weeks ago now, but that's all of your, there's a time to be born and a time to die, etc. That there are all these different seasons of a man's life that are sort of ordered by God, and you will find yourself in one of those one day, and then the next day you might find yourself in the other, and it may not be by your decision, was what we found there in chapter 3. It was a poem about those different times and seasons. Well, here in chapter 7, the first 14 verses, he gets back to that idea and will continue to bring up these comparisons. Again, not all of the ideas that you found in chapter 3, verses 2 through 8, not all of them will be found here in chapter 7, but a lot of them will. For instance, that very first one, there's a time to be born and a time to die. Well, chapter 7 begins answering the question, or maybe settling the doubt or settling the debate kind of if there is a time to do both, where each one is appropriate or where each one is simply going to be what you're doing, is one better than the other? And so the phrase or the word that you keep finding over and over again in chapter 7, he uses it 11 times just in these 14 verses, is the word good or better. That's why we titled this lesson Good and Better. And you can see just kind of glancing down through it, it's set up a lot of ways, better to do this than this. Better to look at this instead of this. He's going to be making a lot of those comparisons between the different seasons that a man's life will go through and trying to give that kind of answer for us. If I'm going to have some of both, which one should I try to have more of? Is kind of the way this section will be set up. But that idea of something being good or something being better is very prevalent throughout this section. So just kind of look at those two passages together. If you're kind of going back over this, look at chapter 3 and compare a lot of the interaction there. All right, so let's look at these first four verses together here in chapter 7. A lot of what this chapter does is it tries to teach us. It tries to teach us these character traits, these views of life that are better, that are the best way of trying to approach things. So, in the first four verses, he makes a statement, just a comparison, kind of a poetic comparison there. A good name is better than precious ointment. And just as that is true, that, you know, reputation, a good character, that's more valuable than anything, even something very valuable. But it's surprising which of the two times he chooses as the one that's preferable. The day of death is better than the day of one's birth. He goes on in verse 2, the house of mourning is preferable to the house of feasting or carousing. That's not what we'd expect. Sorrow in verse 3 is better than laughter. That word sorrow is not necessarily just a sadness. Sometimes it has the idea of anger behind it or vexation. I think a lot of marginal notes will supply the idea of vexation. You're being maybe frustrated by something. You might be sad about it, but more than anything else, you might be just irritated and kind of angry about what's happening. He says that's better than laughter in his mind, in his estimation at this point. Ultimately, in verse 4, the heart of the wise man, and biblically the heart is talking about that kind of seat of the emotions, where a wise man's heart would go, where it would be if he had his choice, and where it would dwell, would be with those who mourn in the house of mourning, not with the fools in the house of mirth. So our question for these first four verses, why? What sense can we make of that? How or why is that the truth that the day of death is better than the day of birth, that the house of mourning is preferable over the house of feasting? How do we find that to be so? Okay. Maybe if we're looking personally, you could say it's the end of the struggle. We have definitely, we mention that often, don't we, when a saint has died, when a brother in Christ has passed on, they are no more, and we look at that and say, we're sorry for their loss. We will miss them, but for them, they absolutely would no longer trade places with any of us. The struggle has ended. And especially in light of all the things he's been building up in these last six chapters, life is hard and life knocks you down and life is unfair and life is just a daily grind and a struggle. Well, the day of death means all of that, at least you get a rest from. And so maybe it's preferable in that regard. Other ideas? Why does the wise man find any use from the mourning, the sorrow, the dwelling on death? Eva? Okay, I think that's absolutely right. What you mentioned verse 2, that phrase at the end of verse 2, the living will take it to heart, is the phrase he uses there. Isn't that what happens when we're confronted with that reality? You start thinking, this will be me someday when you're in the house of mourning. You wonder about the brevity of life. You wonder about the fact that everything is going to end. And you begin thinking, well, what do I have to do as a result of that? Isn't that better to know what you need to do and to be preparing yourself for that time when it will end? Betty? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it's not a comparison of which is more fun, which makes you happier, you know, what should you look forward to the most. There's value. That's what makes it better. It's good. It's something that is useful for you. And each one of those better than that we see, yeah, there's something that you gain from that. Did I see another? Yeah, Ron.
I was going to say, as I recall, Dorcas being dead, mm-hmm. The widows were all mourning and showed all the things she had done. And perhaps that would cause somebody to say, I got to carry on with the work.
Yeah. Yeah. Doesn't that inspire other people sometimes when you maybe see that a void has been created? I need to fill that. And maybe you end up with where one person has gone on, then maybe three or four begin saying, well, we need to be like them. We need to carry on that work. That's a very good point. Sadness itself, I think, I like the way Kidner put this. Sadness is itself a preparation for the truest form of joy, unlike the hectic and empty gaiety of fools. And that's really the idea that he's looking at. I'll go ahead and put that next point up there as well to kind of clarify what we're talking about, especially what he seems to be looking at here with some of the words that he uses, this mirth and the kind of laughter that he's talking about, the feasting or carousing. He has told us before, the preacher has offered on many occasions by this point the opinion or the judgment that sometimes the best you can do is enjoy life. Work hard at the task you've been given, be content with what you have, eat, drink, enjoy the fruit of your labor, etc. It's not to say, don't be happy, don't enjoy yourself. What he's warning against is that life lived in denial of the true nature of things, hoping to push reality to the margins by flooding the senses with sensation and drowning out quiet contemplation with noise. That's what he's arguing against. And so that hectic, empty gaiety, yeah, that doesn't accomplish anything. It might be fun. Again, I suppose there's nothing wrong with it to the extent that sometimes, as we saw from chapter 3, there will be a time to laugh. And you can enjoy that time, and you should embrace that time when it comes. But recognize that when the time of mourning arrives, you might be better off. You might be in a preferred state, a more blessed state, by being in that area of time. But that idea of sadness being preparatory is true as well. Childbirth, I guess, is the most common example we think of, because it is a time of, for the woman at least, it is a time of intense pain and at times a kind of desperate feeling of pain, and you want something to end that is upon you, and it hurts, and there are tears, and there is all this anxiety that's coming about. But then, as soon as that is over with, there is the joy of the child who is now born. And isn't the joy greater for having gone through the greater struggle? And we find that to be the case with many things in life. If everything was this level, unvarying existence, it would be hard to pick out what joy is. It would be hard to understand what happiness is or what laughter actually means if we have just kind of deadened ourselves to the recognition of the up and down. And so being able at times to go to the house of mourning does prepare us to enjoy even more greatly the time when we go to the house of feasting. All right, he continues on in verse 5 here then, along a similar theme of teaching us sobriety, teaching us a proper outlook, a properly serious outlook on life. So you can learn from consideration of death and the fact that everything will end, but we can also learn from other people. We can learn sobriety from those who are wise. And so he mentions words that we don't want to hear can sometimes be the ones that we need to hear. It's better. There again is our better. It's better to hear the rebuke of the wise than for a man to hear the song of fools. I've mentioned the idea before of listening to the jerks, and that can be something useful sometimes. Maybe the person doesn't say something to us kindly. Maybe they say something to us that hurts our feelings. But if we investigate it and find that they're right, it's true, I do need to do something different, I was in the wrong, then I need to listen to that and I need to do better. It is better to hear that than to just go along having a grand old time and everybody's happy and everybody's singing and playing together and I'm still just doing foolish things. Better to hear the rebuke. He mentions in verse 6 there that the laughter of the fool is like the crackling of thorns under a pot. What does that mean? What's the force of that image there? Probably not many of us have burned thorns under a pot. At least I haven't. Yeah, Greg. Okay, noise but no heat, I think is a great way of putting it. You put in those kind of just little bushes, those little kind of useless twig, thorn type things, throw those into a campfire sometime. How long does it take until those are just toast? I mean, just a few seconds, they're gone. Maybe it makes kind of a crackling noise, might make kind of an irritating noise, all those pops and then just a few seconds later, it's all gone. Didn't contribute anything to the fire, didn't really give you any warmth, just annoyed you for a few seconds. And that's what he's saying there about the laughter of fools. Might be fun, might be a great time for a minute, but it's short-lived, and when a wise person hears it, just gets on his nerves. He's just wondering, what are all these idiots laughing about so much? What's so funny to them? Don't we need to be serious and look at what is actually going on in our lives? Can't we take a moment to reflect on what is truly important? So that laughter of a fool is ultimately a dangerous thing. So, sober reflection on life, that's better. There's the comparison we keep seeing over and over. Comments, questions, anything to mention up through about verse 6? All those kind of related so far. All right, verse 7 then is a bit of a shift. It's a proverb that doesn't, to me at least, in reading through it, doesn't immediately seem to go with what we've seen in the verses before. But notice a connection there, especially going back to verse 4. You see a mention of the man's heart, the heart of a hopefully wise man, is what's under consideration. And this starts building to a particular view of the world that we need to adopt. What he's saying that can debase the heart, or what can destroy the heart, is a bribe or oppression. He's kind of dealing in both ways with a monetary occurrence of some kind. Maybe having been oppressed and trying to get out of that through accepting a bribe, through an upward mobility that is not above board. This pursuit of happiness that a man might go on, he wants the laughter of fools, he wants to go to the house of feasting. If he does that at the expense of his integrity, at the expense of having this good heart that hasn't been debased, is it worth it? Is that a good trade at all? It's very similar to what Jesus asks much later on. If a man were to gain the whole world but lose his soul, is that a good trade? Absolutely not. So there's this kind of otherwise wise man who is compromising that integrity in his pursuit of worldly wealth. That would be just as foolish as the people that we met in the first five verses. So we're starting to see an advocacy for contentment, for not chasing upward. And he'll come back to this idea at the end of the section as well. Any other things on verse 7 there? Just that kind of little insertion into the argument.
It's also the idea of impatience.
Okay. Okay, growing impatient and discontent with your station, with where you are. You want to kind of chase things up the ladder more and more quickly, and that is going to bridge into what we start seeing in verse 8 as well. I do think that's present there in verse 7. So it does kind of get us from one to the other. So look at verses 8 through 10. The end of a thing is better than its beginning. The patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Do not hasten in your spirit to be angry, for anger rests in the bosom of fools. Do not say, "Why were the former days better than these?" For you do not inquire wisely concerning this. The end of a thing is better than its beginning. Always true? Does it have to be always true for it to be biblical wisdom, for it to be a proverb? No, this is, we've talked about this kind of at the beginning of the class, I think. A lot of these proverbs that we see are things that are maybe true, all other things being equal, or are true some of the time. They do not have to literally always be the case. It's just encouraging us to see things through a certain lens. Erica. Yeah, you get the ability to improve. You gain all of that experience, and in that sense, you could say again, ideally, the case might be that it's better in the end than at the beginning. We say sometimes youth is wasted on the young, and you know, well, yeah, if I had as much physical capability now that I do, if I had my older person's brain and my younger person's body, wouldn't that have been good? Because now I know how to live. Now I know how to do things. Now I know what are the correct principles to live by. And you don't have those maybe when you're younger. And in that sense, Yeah, there's some improvement. There's the idea we talk sometimes about leaving things better than when you found them and trying to make sure that when your friendships end, it's not because of acrimony, that when your business relationships end, they don't end on a sour note, that, you know, when you move to a different place, it's not from people running you out of town with pitchforks. The end of a thing is better than its beginning. Can have several different applications, several things that were intended to take from that. But I think overall it is just kind of encouraging this certain outlook that is geared towards patience. When something looks bad now, maybe keep in mind that sometimes the end is better than the beginning. Hold on, be patient. Maybe it will improve. Maybe there will actually be benefit that comes out of that. You might have some trials, but maybe they're just going to be around for a little while. Maybe that will just be a short-lived difficulty, and the sun is just about to rise. And so be patient. The end is, can be, better than its beginning. And so that's why he connects it in verse 8 to that patience. The patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. So really verses 8, 9, and 10, I think, are three different difficulties, three different negative responses that people have instead of this patient outlook. In verse 8, it's the proud in spirit, and that's kind of the arrogant impatience. Things should be going better for me right now. I deserve to have things working out for me better than they are now. It's that kind of pride in spirit. In verse 9, don't hasten in your spirit to be angry. That's a foolish way to live. Again, kind of the idea of just not being satisfied with where we are and getting mad about it and wanting things to go ahead and hurry up. I don't want to have to wait in line. I don't want to have to wait on this person. I don't want to have to bide my time and wait on the Lord. I want it all now. Or in verse 10, why were the former days better than these? That kind of useless glorification, and probably an inaccurate one, of longing for days past, the glory days. Boy, back then, it was all so much easier back in high school, wasn't it? It was all so much easier back when I was a little kid. Boy, the 60s were so much better than now. And in the 60s, the people said the 30s were so much, well, maybe not the 30s, but the 50s were so much better than now. And it just keep going back and back and saying, boy, it was always better way back then. So don't say that. Why were the former days better than these? That's not a wise question. Just focus on what is now. Focus on what the opportunities, the challenges, and the benefits are of living right now in this present time, and be patient to see what happens next and what you will be able to do next. Very, very good point. And it is in line with exactly the point he's making here. The end is better than the beginning. Sometimes being able to close that chapter, then you see, well, maybe it wasn't as bad as it could have been, or it's not as bad as I thought it was. And then when you're in something that feels bad right now, you don't know that about the current. You do know it about the past. So, yeah, good point there. All right, so.
Hard and difficult things are good for you, I think it's more.
Yes.
That might be what the point is, too.
And that's going back to verse 5. The same way that rebuke is tough to hear, but you need to hear it. Sometimes having that patience to endure something we don't like right now is, to use our word that we keep finding, it's better. It's useful. It provides value. Look for the benefit in it. All right, verse 11 then, verses 11 and 12. Try and move kind of quickly through these. He mentions in verse 11, wisdom is good with an inheritance and profitable to those who see the sun. He will mention a couple of things here that can be good. In fact, he says they're kind of universally useful. If you have wisdom, and if you have money, an inheritance, a legacy, he's looking financially there. Is how it seems to be, and verse 12 makes that very clear. So, those are useful things. They're good things, or at least can be. Verse 12, wisdom is a defense as money is a defense. All these things that we've seen in the first six chapters that trip men up and make us miserable and make us wonder what's the meaning of life and why do we have to deal with all of this. If you have wisdom, you have some knowledge about how to navigate your way through life, you might be shielded from some of those. If you have a nice fortune to fall back on, you might be able to navigate your way out of some of those problems as well. The advantage, and really I think at the end of verse 12, the comparison then becomes, all right, both are good, both are better than not having, but if you're looking at those two even in comparison to each other, the excellence of knowledge is that wisdom gives life to those who have it, which seems to be indicating then money cannot, money can't do that, I think is the comparison that he's making there. Now, the question would be, in what sense are we to take this? Is this one of Koheleth's rare moments of speaking spiritually, where he's saying wisdom can, as Jesus would say much later, can actually provide life, can actually give you life and life more abundantly? Is that what he's looking at? Or is it more consistent to see his arguments that he's made previously that are just kind of saying, well, if you're just trying to stay alive, if you're just trying to make as good of a go at it as you can right now, wisdom will be more useful than money. If you know how to stay alive, you know, you have your wits about you, that's the most important thing. You can always make more money. I think, I don't know what I think about this, actually. I wrestle with it back and forth all week, kind of looking at this. I don't know which one makes more sense for him to be saying there right now. They're both true. I think it would be accurate either way. I kind of lean towards the former of him having one of those kind of rare spiritual insights, because in verse 13 he's going to point us back to the work of God and say to consider that. And so I do think it makes sense for him to be saying right here, knowledge, wisdom gives life. Those are things that can actually provide what you need, what you truly want and need in life. Your thoughts there, comments, questions on 11 and 12. Run. Rob, sorry. Yeah.
The usage of the word knowledge and then wisdom immediately following that is deliberate, or is it just kind of a convention because he doesn't want to use the word wisdom so many times in a row?
Right.
But, I mean, normally I think of knowledge as just the facts and wisdom, the ability to use those facts to discern in a righteous and upright way. But
yep. I tend to think he's using them kind of synonymously, just because of the way he says the advantage of this is that you can, and then you could almost say it, because he's telling us what the advantage is. So, but good point. I mean, there are shades of meaning within all of those that you can observe and draw some conclusions from, I guess. All right, so the look that he has had previously, wisdom, wealth, in those two passages I've cited then, may not really do that much for you, may not really provide all that much lasting benefit. They can be classified and have been classified, as many things have throughout Ecclesiastes, as vanity. Breath, just mere breath. That disappears as soon as it's out of your mouth. If you try to gain profit from either, and there's our other word that we see time and again throughout Ecclesiastes, profit, gain, advantage, what do I get out of having this thing? They don't answer that either. If you have either money or great wisdom and you're trying to rig the game of life to work in your advantage so that you win, Those don't get it done either. You can't accomplish it through that means. But in verse 13, chapter 2 and verse 13, clearly if you're picking between wisdom or folly, that's a no-brainer. Okay, wisdom may not be able to answer for everything, but it's good to have. It doesn't hurt, right? It's good to be a person of understanding. So go in that direction. Really what he's pointing out at the end of all of this, by saying wisdom and money are both good, they're both good to have, they are profitable in their way, if you can have both and you're not sacrificing these other things and you're not debasing your heart or whatever it might be, go for it. You just need to know how to use them appropriately is going to be his ultimate conclusion. All right, very quickly, verses 13 and 14, getting back to this idea of contentment. He's going to kind of wrap up the argument here. Ultimately, as we've observed before, we have very little control over many things. We saw that in chapter 6, verse 10, and it's a point he's made several times. But in verse 13, consider the work of God. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? Like Gamaliel says in the book of Acts, you're going to fight against God and win? Of course not. You're not going to be able to undo something that he once done. So that's the advice. Consider the work of God. That's where it all begins. Think about that fact that you are not God and he is. That he is in heaven and you are on earth, as we saw back in chapter 5. God continues to work his own way in his own time. And this ties back to chapter 3, our poem that we're revisiting here. Remember, it is God who has made everything beautiful in its time. He has the appropriate choices in those matters. We can't undo his deeds. We can't foresee his deeds. We don't know what he is going to give, whether the time to laugh or the time to weep, whatever it might be. Provan just kind of summarizes those ideas there. The embrace of wisdom doesn't give one leverage in respect to God so that the future becomes predictable. Wisdom is great, but it doesn't solve the game for you. It doesn't reach those that level where you're not struggling, you're not wrestling through anymore. So what's the appropriate response? Just despair and become depressed that, man, there's no way out of this, there's no way to win, there's no way to gain advantage? Is the right response to just have that heart of fools and just keep going back to the house of mirth and just kind of drown yourself in enjoyment of life? Is it to just say, I'm quitting all of this, I'm going to be a hermit up in the woods and I'm not ever going to see or talk to anyone, I'm not going to have any possessions, I'm just going to kind of live out my life as long as it takes me to just kind of wither away out there, away from society and away from the entire rest of the world, and I just won't worry about anything else? None of those are really the appropriate response. Instead, it's the same conclusion he keeps reaching over and over again in these circumstances. You have contentment, you accept what comes, and you deal with that as well as you can. In the day of prosperity, be joyful. In the day of adversity, consider. That's going to have its benefits too. Surely God has appointed one as well as the other so that man can find out nothing that will come after him. The future might be good. It might be difficult. When you prosper, give thanks. Be joyful for that. When there's difficulty and suffering, consider God's power. Consider the fact that it is his authority that puts these things in the order that they are in. And consider his wisdom to see us through those times and to perhaps be teaching us something through those times. So, good, bad, in between, consider God. And don't take any of these other avenues to trying to find wisdom or meaning or answers. It's ultimately the same conclusion that keeps coming back. Live your life with as great a wisdom as you can. Be content with what you have and consider God before anything else. All right, there are people trickling in, and that means that it is time for me to clam up. Thank you very, very much. Really appreciate the time this evening. We covered a lot of ground. I'm kind of proud of myself, actually. We got through what I intended, even if I had to rush it a little bit. So thank you so much for your time, your comments. We'll pick up in chapter 7 next week.